Hello, Majority Report listeners. It's me, Sam Cedar. Remember me? Look, you know we don't get a lot of sponsors for our show. We get some, but we don't get a lot. And a big reason of that is because we do a politics show. But to the extent that we do get sponsors, it really is a function of the survey that we ask you to take once a year. Because this basically tells advertisers who our audience is in general terms, demographic terms, et cetera, et cetera. And it matches us up with advertisers that may want to reach you guys. So you go to podsurvey.com. That's podsurvey.com/majority. The survey will only take you 5 minutes. We're going to ask you some questions about yourself, et cetera, what you like to buy. Completely anonymous. And like I say, your answers help us to match our show with advertisers. And, you know, we also filter out advertisers that we don't really appreciate the product. Sometimes because we're with politics, you'll get a request from, you know, a place like what's that debt, Matt? What's that debt place? I don't know. There was one time I got it from literally a New Democrat thing. We had to reject the ad. But when you're finished, if you want to give your email address, you don't have to. You'd enter a monthly drawing for a $100 Amazon gift card. So once you take even if you've taken our survey in the past, take this one because we need to update it, and it basically matches us up with advertisers. That's podsurvey.com/majority. Please check it out, fill it out. It'll take you 5 minutes. It's definitely worth it.
You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, June 8th, 2015. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live, steps from the industrial ravaged Gowanus Canal.
In the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Mark Ames, editor at Pando Daily. We're talking about muckraking, why corporate muckraking doesn't happen in American media, but government muckraking does. What else we got, Matt?
We will be looking at the video that hopefully you've seen by now. If not, it went viral over the weekend of a McKinney cop in a town in Texas, showing up at a pool party and literally doing the most obscene things you could ever think of a cop doing to 14-year-olds who were there for a pool party.
We're talking about the racist backlash to that racist incident. Also, an update on Turkey's election results. Big deal there yesterday. A lot of news from that part of the world that actually impacts you, even if you don't realize it. So a lot to get to today.
Yes, including our good pal George Bush doing something nice, but also a little bit...
little enlightened self-interest.
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
Sorry, Sam isn't here for that, but I think we do a respectable job. All right, everybody. We're going to take a brief break on this M&M Monday on a rainy June 8th day in New York City. Take a brief break, and we'll be right back with Mark Ames.
Rock me nice and easy. Rock me nice and slow. I'm in the early morning, and you turn.
when the honor so let the good times roll. I said them try fi separate with, but me no wanna crack fi smoke. Give me the idol in my brain and let it light up in my dome. I wonder if I'm me alone one steaming the sense every time. I wonder if I'm me alone one burning every time. I say fi give me the highest grade. I tell you it's the perfect tree and let it light up in my brain. Perfect tree. I love my marijuana. Rasta man, strictly herbs for me. Ooh, 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 ooh. Whoa, ooh, ooh, ooh. So baby, I say me granny say not touch it, and he say grandma you're insane. Nobody incriminate no coaching. It never hurt nobody's brain. It is the healing of the nation. Mama, what you talking about? I said it good for your meditation. And she said, boy, just shut your mouth. But all I need is the highest grade. Oh, mama, it's the perfect tree. And let it light up in my brain.
We are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Mark Ames. He's a senior editor at Pando. How you doing, Mark?
Good. How you doing?
Doing really well, man. And I should just say, as a heads up to our listeners, Mark is joining us from the field. And by field, I mean a park by his apartment where he is needed to and has been so generous, frankly, to sort of get away from his family and his amazing newborn to join us for a little while. So appreciate it, man.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. My son has already said he's going to remember you forever for this. But
really?
Oh yeah.
Well,
he has a long memory.
I love it.
Pissed off.
Yeah. Well, of course he's pissed off. I appreciate that. So there'll be some. We could make probably some type of like gangster grudge match vehicle about, you know, between me and your son. I'm open to it.
Be careful. He's big. He's already big, so be careful.
Dude, I'm careful, but I'm crafty. So you have this really, really interesting new piece in Pando called Seymour Hersh and the Dangers of Corporate Muckraking. And what I liked so much about this piece is it hits a lot of themes that you hit a lot, Mark, which is sort of like really sort of shedding light on why is it easier on both the left and right to sort of expose government malfeasance, which is important. You're in no way diminishing or undermining the importance of those stories. But there's also this corporate power, this corporate corollary in all of these issues we talk about. That isn't addressed in the same way. Is that another kid?
It is. It's Park here.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So you explained Seymour Hersh. The way the story starts is basically in Seymour Hersh's sort of heyday in the 1970s. He's exposed the My Lai massacre. He's at the New York Times, and he wants to take on corporate power. Take us from there.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was just, it started with me actually being curious. Why hasn't this, you know, the most bloodthirsty, aggressive, impressive muckraker, as they call him of our time, like, why hasn't he gone after corporate private power the way he has after government public power, knowing that muckraking, you know, the original muckrakers went almost, you know, more so than after government power, they went after private corporate power, which
right.
rose up. In the late 19th century, Rockefeller, Standard Oil, the coal companies, so on and so forth. And so I wondered that, and I looked, and there is actually a story about what happened. Seymour Hersh, you know, he was considered hit politically very much on the left. Abe Rosenthal used to call him my little commie, and you know, sort of ironically, affectionately, in the newsroom at the New York Times. And it turned out that Hirsch himself decided after, you know, after the Mili expose and after the really big expose on CIA domestic spying in 75, 74, 75, the MH chaos program, in which the CIA illegally, you know, spied on probably up to hundreds and thousands of Americans,
right,
leading to the Church Committee and all that. He said after that, okay, the next big story in the next 10 years is corporate power. And, you know, the thing you have to remember is that back then, and his biographer talked about this too, in the 70s, the basic assumptions were very different about, you know, private corporate power versus government power. The basic assumption, people were far more openly, and the culture was more openly skeptical of, you know, and if not hostile towards corporate power.
Right.
And it was much more on the front and center of people's thoughts. You know, today you have all these like bizarre assumptions that somehow private power, corporate power, is not as dangerous as government power. As if, for example, one of the falsehoods I hear a lot, oh, well, companies, private companies can't put you behind bars the way a government can. That's just BS. I mean,
they
operate
private prisons, for God's sake.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, they operate them, but they constantly work with law enforcement to put people behind bars all the time. I mean,
right.
I wrote about eBay doing this. Like the head of the security for eBay at one conference with a bunch of police and FBI people bragged about how eBay in just a short period of time had put away, you know, thousands of arrests around the globe with their global security force. Anybody who knows anything about the PayPal 14 knows that eBay PayPal ran the prosecution. I mean, it's a pretty shocking case if you ever read it. They ran the whole prosecution of that case against the PayPal 14.
So circling back to Hirsch for a minute, to get back to the story.
Yeah.
I think that that's a really interesting point, though, just a side note, that he, in the 70s, even with this very different attitude, he was anticipating the environment and the climate of the 70s and 80s, which would set the stage for the assumptions you're talking about today, which was the kind of neoliberal backlash, and that was the sort of empowerment of corporations. So he saw it as a perceptive muckraker and journalist in the 1970s.
He had a nose for where coercive power was. And coercive power is both in the, you know, in the military and in intelligence areas in the government, and then in these, you know, huge new growing corporations. And so he chose to go after what was a very infamous company of its time in the 60s and 70s called Gulf and Western.
Gulf and Western to us a little bit. I mean, you got this mafia-connected lawyer who's involved in it. It's amazing. I mean, just bring out that company a little bit. Bring it to life a little bit. And because it's also just a great target for anybody who has a sense of what a good story is. I mean, it's mind-blowing, the power and reach of this company and the intimacy between, you know, the criminal economy and the corporate economy. There's a lot to it.
And the characters. I mean, it had great characters. And it shows, again, you know, that Hirsch has always had a great nose for a good story. The problem, as I'll tell you in a minute, was what happens when you try to write about corporate power. You have to bring in the lawyers and the editors in a way you don't have to when you write about government. So in any event, Gulf and Western began in the 50s as an auto parts company. And it was run by this guy who was the New Yorker in the 90s after he was dead, called the last great business eccentric. His name was Charlie Bluedorn. He was also known as the Mad Austrian. He was originally from Austria. He, you know, had a lot of energy and he was, you know, notoriously aggressive as hell and scary. And he wound up striking up basically a really good relationship first with Chase Bank and then Hanover Manhattan, I think was the other one. Mm-hmm. Manufacturers Hanover, I'm sorry. And these banks basically, they open up the spigot for him to finance an acquisition spree. And the banks made money kind of on both ends because the more – like they would have clients on one end and then Gulf and Western on the other end, and they would make money off both ends on the deals. So they were encouraged to really keep financing these acquisitions that he would make. And he wanted to do it because his stock price would go, the more he would acquire, the more value his company had, and the more his stock price went up, and the more leverage he would then get over the banks to pull out personal loans. I mean, it was a very, very convoluted and, fraud-ridden.
It sounds very modern.
It does, but, yeah. You start to think about what the banks did here in the 2000s or what the SNLs did. I mean, they basically load up on borrowed money and then turn it into their personal ATM. That's kind of what he did with Gulf and Western. And, he really attracted a lot of attention when he bought Paramount Pictures in 66, I think. Mm-hmm. And then in 68, he attracted more attention when he cut this very strange deal with one of the most notorious mafia financiers, of the 20th century, Michele Sindona. Michele Sindona was, he ran the money laundering for the Sicilian Mafia's global heroin operations. He was also known as God's banker because he had the ear of one of the popes, and he managed the Vatican's global properties. He also helped the CIA move money around the world. And in 68, 69, he cut a deal with Gulf and Western, which, by the way, was considered – Gulf and Western was so aggressive that Wall Street nicknamed them Engulf and Devour. And if you've ever seen that Mel Brooks movie, Silent Movie, the evil corporation in it was called Engulf and Devour, as a movie from the mid-70s. Right. In any event, one of the companies, subsidiaries that Gulf and Western bought, I think it was called Commercial something or other. Anyway, some New Hampshire company. It was totally worthless, and it was creating a problem for the books, for Gulf and Western's books. So somehow they managed to swap how many millions of dollars worth of totally worthless commercial paper in the subsidiary with Michele Sindona's Italian finance company. 10% stake in that company, and then they swapped back half of Paramount Pictures' movie lot back to Sindona, and then they asked Sindona about it afterwards, and he said, I like to give pieces of companies undervalued to friends who I want to do favors for. I mean, it just makes, no sense whatsoever.
Unless you're a Sicilian financier, then that might make some sense.
Yes, exactly. And so, this was just one of the many shady schemes that Hirsch wound up getting into. Another one is they own basically the largest employer in the Dominican Republic, where, the U.S. Has been intervening militarily and otherwise, throughout the whole century. And they basically, they own the sugar business there, Gulf and Western did. They own the sugar refinery. They were the largest employer. And they, when the Dominican Republic Central Bank needed more money on its books, Gulf and Western would illegally funnel money their way against SEC rules. And when Gulf and Western needed more money on its books, to try to boost the share, the Dominican Republic Central Bank would funnel money back into their accounts. It was all it was crazy. So
you have everything. You have mafia. Yeah. You have incredible just sort of rampant corporate criminality. You have our policy of coup and dictatorship in Latin America. And then seeing the trend of corporate power. So Hirsch sees all of this, and this is going to be his next major expose.
Exactly. So he goes to the New York Times and says, this is going to be the big story. I've already proven I have a nose for this stuff. I have a Pulitzer. Corporate power, and this company embodies everything that's wrong with overweening corporate power in this country. These guys are now the 19th largest employers. They're violating every rule in the book. They're not using the money to sort of innovate and grow and do something good. They're actually just using the money as personal ATMs. And so he gets to go ahead. Everybody's totally for it. And he winds up hooking up with Jeff Gerth, who's now at ProPublica. Mm-hmm. I think he did the Whitewater. I think he first broke the Whitewater stories in the 90s. Anyway, and they wound up spending, a very long time digging into Gulf and Western and all of the problems they're having. And there was a lot of buildup, oh, my God, Hirsch is going after corporate America now. And there's a lot of, anticipation of the story, what would happen when it finally came out. And in mid-1977, they finally released a series. It was a three-part series, 13,000 words in total. And it landed with a whimper, an absolute whimper. The stories are dull, turgid. Mm. Everything a Seymour Hirsch story is not, you know. And then you start going back into, well, why? How did that happen? Why did the stories have so little effect, and why are they so unreadable and such a disappointment? And then we found out the whole process Hirsch had to go through to even get these stories published. And what happens is, I mean, when you're a journalist and you want to go after a company, first of all, companies can do a lot more to journalists. They can threaten you in far bigger and worse ways overtly.
Yeah, explain that a little bit. That's because I think people, again, intuitively, they'd say, well, wait a second. If you're going up against the NSA or the CIA or, you know, a covert intelligence or military organization that has, you know, vast surveillance powers, is involved in all sorts of extrajudicial things, how can a corporation have more overt power? It makes total sense to me, but, you know, tease that out a little bit.
Well, I mean, first of all, they're considered people,
right? There you
right,
go.
And yeah. You know, under our laws, and the government is constrained by the Constitution. The government is constrained by the Constitution that, you know, that's what we're all, you know, worried about these days, that, you know, it shouldn't be able to surveil you. I mean, somebody can hire a private detective,
right?
Right, and it's, I mean, it's legal. Maybe you can sue them, but you can't. If you can prove some kinds of damages to your life, you can maybe sue them.
I want you to fill it, but like an example would be like if the FBI or the CIA send people to follow and monitor a journalist who's covering them, that's a big deal. A corporation can hire any private contractor they want to do anything they want to, I mean, short of obviously like physical harm. But they can go through somebody's garbage. They can, you know, that's par for the course.
Well, and as Hirsch and the people writing about Hirsch's story said in the 70s as well, the things that Gulf and Western said and did, I mean, they openly threatened Hirsch many times. They did everything to try to get him and Jedgert fired. They openly told Hirsch, you know, we're digging up information on your families and on Jedgert's father that's going to be very damaging. He told him that straight up. No fear whatsoever. Now, and as they said at the time, everybody said, if that happened in the government, you'd have resignation. You'd have a huge ongoing, you know, story, and then you'd have people resigning. Nobody in private government, you know, let's call them private government, this is what they are, resigns over that. And they don't, and, you know, it's assumed these days, our cultural assumption is that their only, fealty is only to, then their only responsibility is to their shareholders to maximize profit. They don't have any responsibility to, you know, to the public whatsoever. And they don't have to. They're not constrained by the Constitution. So, what Hirsch found out was that going after these guys, the threats of lawsuits were so great. I mean, the NSA, you know, the CIA couldn't threaten, didn't threaten to sue, the New York Times over Hirsch exposing the domestic spying program. They weren't going to sue the New York Times out of existence. And in fact, the New York Times had already won, you know, landmark First Amendment rights cases in the Supreme Court about its right to publish the Pentagon Papers and other classified documents. So, you know, the New York Times knew that it's protected against the public government power, but it's not protected. And we all know this. Every journalist knows this. Every journalist knows that, you know, you might fear in the back of your head that the government could do something secretly without you ever knowing that could screw up your life, you know, or there's a fear that they'll kill you or, you know, whatever. But we know that they are actually constrained, and they can't get away with it. But with private corporations, first of all, you can't FOIA them, and good luck suing them. I mean, what's Jeff Gerst going to do? Sue Gulf and Western for threatening him? You know, who's got the money for that? Right. These guys were clearly ready to go all out to make life hell for them, and they did. And so the New York Times, unlike any of his stories on the CIA or the My Lai massacre or anything, they held up the story. They made it go through. They had lawyers vetting it in ways that none of his stories about government were vetted. They had editors. They put a team of editors on it. They were threatened, you know, repeatedly. Hearst himself said that the experience from Gulf and Western's executives and their lawyers and the abuse that he put up with and the threats that he put up with was unlike anything by far that he had ever dealt with when investigating the CIA or the military. He'd never dealt with anything like it, and he didn't want to repeat the experience again. He was destroyed by it. Yeah. The article came out like crap, and he just thought, you know, as a career move, it's a bad career move. It's not worth it to fight corporate power. And so he never wrote about corporations again after that. He went back to writing about Henry Kissinger. You know, we all hate Henry Kissinger, and there's no fear of, you know, of the sort of retaliation that he had to deal with when writing about, you know, Gulf and Western.
Well, and for what it's worth, for all of the writing about Henry Kissinger that's sort of been exhaustively done, there's not as much, you know, written about his private consulting work. And even so, what's fascinating about the article too is that, you know, these articles, as sort of boring and as pared down as they became, actually did have an effect on Hirsch's target and on Gulf and Western. So even that said, it still had some impact. And then I guess
some impact eventually. Yeah. It just wasn't the dramatic impact that people expected. I mean, you know, again, the big series he did before that, the CIA domestic spying program, had the greatest effect, I think, besides the Watergate stories, the greatest effect of pretty much any, you know, muckraking of our time, which was the Church Committee hearings and the Pike Committee hearings and the Rockefeller Commission. I mean, it was that you know, rippled for years afterwards. And I think Hirsch's bad experience and the New York Times' bad experience going after corporate power and going after Gulf and Western in such a deep, profound way. You know, I mean, he wasn't just going after one thing they did. He really went after, it's kind of fascinating, he went after the companies, both their sort of their wrongdoings, but also kind of structurally, you really got, he peeled the whole thing open. And, you know, corporations want to live in secrecy. Yeah. You know, as do spy agencies. I mean, that's, I think, another thing that attracted him to this. And he really kind of peeled it open. You got to look at a conglomerate on a lot of different levels in a way that hadn't been done before and really hasn't been done since. I mean, you know, one of the things I think I'm learning writing about corporate power here in the technology sector and haven't looked, you know, and haven't written a bit about certainly like the Koch brothers and finance, is how little we actually understand about the architecture of corporate power today. I mean, I think it's definitely a lot different from the conglomerate architecture that Hirsch wrote about. I mean, that was a new thing in the 60s and 70s. The conglomerates were then destroyed. It's a whole nother story, but they kind of went by the wayside and new structures kind of came up in the years since then. And we don't understand anything. We do not even, no one could tell you the structure of Google or Facebook. I mean, the full structure, eBay, you know, Coke Industries for that matter. Like, no one can tell you the structure of it. There are no, you know, NGOs that are dedicated to transparency of corporate architecture and corporate power. You know, the only place that people seem to be interested at all in corporate power is where it intersects with government power, which really just reinforces, you know, the whole focus on government power.
Right. And you see, that's so important because I think that that's been, you know, as we sort of move to closing this up, that's been something that you have really focused on a lot. And it's very important. And obviously, exposing NSA surveillance, exposing all of this, you know, all of these covert programs that have happened under basically the war on terrorism framework through Bush and Obama, is incredibly important. But even as we look at, like, you know, the supposed reform bills in Congress to rein in aspects of the Patriot Act, well, first of all, obviously they're incredibly limited and tepid reforms. But a lot of it is just sort of turning into, like, well, you know, government doesn't store metadata. Now the phone companies just will. And basically, first of all, yeah, government will have access to it whenever they want, regardless. And then, you know, this whole other question, which is that these companies whose whole sort of business model is built off of just incredibly sophisticated data mining, essentially. No one's talking about a sort of 21st century framework for consumer protections and for transparency and for how, you know, the sort of digital equivalents of putting seatbelts in cars. That conversation has been off the table because there isn't this scrutiny on corporate power, like you've pointed out. And then we have these anecdotes like, you know, Uber, some people have taken shots at them, pretty minimal shots. And there you already have a CEO at a dinner saying like, hey, maybe I should, you know, I should send some private detectives after people who say negative stuff about us.
That was my editor, actually, Sarah right. Lacey. Yeah, yeah, it was Emil Michael, the executive there. Yeah, saying he was going to put a lot of money, $1 million, into following and smearing her family, actually.
Right.
She's got two children. Yeah, that and you know, no fallout from that. I mean, look, the Snowden. If you ask the Snowden revelations, the most significant ones, and the ones I wish so badly that were followed up on, and I think a lot of other journalists do. Well, the Verizon one, you know, was big and great, and it confirmed, I think, the USA Today exposés in 2006. The Prism ones, the ones about Silicon Valley big tech companies, you know, working together with them, that to me was, that was the big one. And that one, we haven't really heard anything about NSA. We've heard very little about NSA and tech since then from the documents. We've heard nothing about contractors. And, you know, we know from Tim Sharrock that 70% of the NSA is already privatized. 70% of the budget outlays go to contractors for the NSA. So it's more of a private organization than a public one. And, you know, part of that, obviously, is so that people can make money. And part of that is also when you have this murky public-private thing, accountability and legal accountability become themselves that much more murky. It's disappointing that so much of the story has since, you know, just almost exclusively focused on big bad government. The government obviously in this case is bad, but it's not, you're not really getting the story. It would be at least as bad if they only went after the companies and said nothing bad whatsoever about the NSA, and only went after sort of like the companies that were doing something. I don't know why that's the case. It's hard for me to believe that out of the tens of thousands of documents, there's not more about contractors in there. But we just don't know. I mean, I don't know why we don't know more about that. It's just a big part of the story that seems to be missing, and hopefully it'll still come out. And it's a big part of the story in general that we're missing, I think, as, you know, that journalists aren't writing enough about. And again, because it makes their life a lot harder. The corporate private side of all this stuff. It's just a lot harder to do it. You have a lot more legal and sort of career roadblocks when you write about corporate power. And when you challenge corporate power than you do if you write about government. As a journalist, it's easier culturally for people to understand these days. The villain and the good guy. But more importantly, it's just easier to get it past your editor. They're not going to worry about getting sued out of existence if they write about government malfeasance compared to corporate malfeasance.
Absolutely. And just, you know, as a final thought, because I a lot of this still also definitely goes back, and we've talked about how this sort of, you know, the Scientology of politics, which is how I talk about libertarianism, has kind of like, you know, defined so much of our era. And, you know, this is the problem. I mean, practically speaking, and just even like civically, I think building coalitions and where you can work with people on intelligence reform and on prison reform is great. And I'm willing to work with libertarians on those issues and have conversations. But there is such a fundamental problem, because that coalition and that conversation is only going to deal with the governmental aspect of this. And as you point out, with the role of contractors, even practically speaking, it's not really going to rein in an out of control intelligence system. And then more broadly, it's going to do nothing to sort of lay the rules of the road for how we manage basically, you know, tech capitalism and 21st century capitalism. And that's the name of the game right now, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, yeah, and I think culturally we kind of ceded, we just gave up on politics in some way by in the late 70s or early 80s. And so, you know, I mean, liberals before then, certainly like liberals from the progressive era to the New Deal era, were a lot more attuned to, you know, a corporate power and how coercive and destructive it could be. And I think because they were a lot more aligned with labor.
Right.
And so you understand these things a lot more. And, you know, you just think about it intuitively. I mean, the fear of what the NSA could do is, I mean, it's potentially, you know, Orwellian, absolutely Orwellian, what they could potentially do with all this information that they're getting. But in reality, the overwhelming majority of us are much more impacted by private technology, private sector surveillance, let's just say, surveillance and you know, the use of private information about our credit histories, which may or may not be true, or our reputations, our online reputations, which may or may not be true. And we can't FOIA to get access to this and have it change. And this may affect our ability to, you know, buy a car or to get a job or to get health insurance. You know, all these things actually affect our mundane lives. But it's less sexy than the possibility of an Orwellian, Big Brother state, like creating the sort of movie set, you know, horror film atmosphere.
Right.
And so, you know, the dramatics are much bigger in the government. And then it's a lot harder to write about what the corporations are doing. It's harder to get it past your editors, and it's harder to write about, and it's harder to get information.
Well, Mark Ames, I really appreciate you doing it, and it's always fun talking with you, and always it's great. I appreciate your time as always, man, and I'll talk to you soon.
Cool. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Right.
All right, folks, we are going to take a brief switch. Matt is going to bring you a story and take us into the fun half, and then we'll switch back up then. You're listening to the Majority Report. You got it?
Driving on night, you could be a shadow beneath the streetlight behind my home. Driving on nine, I sure miss you. Pass a motel, looking at the pines. Driving on nine, look for 30. Maybe I passed it. Go. Shotgun. He said he'd never need one.
are back on the Majority Report. Hello, everybody. Let's get to one more story, and then we'll go to the better half. We wanted to give this one to Freebies, too, because this story is... excuse me. This story is very important, because it is quite unbelievable. To sort of understand where our minds are when we hear about these sort of things, is for this weekend, when this video that I'm about to show you was uploaded this weekend. It was on the events shown in the video happened on Friday. The video was uploaded on Saturday. And I actually didn't hear about the video until Sunday. And when I first heard people talking about it, you know, because of the world we live in right now, the country we live in right now, the first thing I thought of when hearing people talk about McKinney, Texas was, oh my God, what young black teen has been killed by an overzealous police officer now? Thankfully, in this video, nobody dies. But the things you will see in this video, and for those listening via the podcast, the things you will hear in this video, it easily could have escalated to that point because it was close. And the things in this video are no less disgusting. And, you know, this is done. This video, the people in this video the police are running after are 14-year-olds who were attending a pool party in McKinney, Texas. And apparently, police were called out to this pool party after a fight reportedly broke out at the Craig Ranch North Community Pool. And in a statement that the police posted on Facebook, they confirmed that they responded on Friday evening to a disturbance call regarding a group of teenagers who do not live in the area or have permission to be there. So the police show up to see what was going on, to make these unwelcome guests, these 14-year-old teenagers, who I would like to add were all people of color. You'll see mostly black kids. There were Hispanic kids and Arabic kids there too. And the person who took the video points out, Brandon Brooks spoke to BuzzFeed News. Brandon is white. He said that he uploaded the video to YouTube. I think a bunch of white parents were angry that a bunch of black kids who don't live in the neighborhood were in the pool, he said. Everyone who was getting put on the ground was black, Mexican, Arabic. The cop didn't even look at me. It was kind of like I was invisible. So we're going to, this is about a 7.5 minute long video that Brandon posted. I'm going to play certain parts of it. You can easily find the whole video up online. We'll post a link too on our, at majority.fm. Michael, why don't you play that first clip that we played?
Matt, don't run!
Move! Move!
Man, what the fuck?
Run it out! Let's go! Run
it out! He has a flashlight.
God,
I got a flashlight,
buddy.
Oh, shit. Oh, shit, bro.
This nigga fell.
Do you see him?
Hey, let me go give it to him.
No, I want to give it to him.
No. Hey, let me give it to him.
No, I want to give it to him.
It was him. It was him.
She got like a blackout right
now. No. It wasn't his. It wasn't his.
It was his.
Greg,
I'm shit. Don't take off running when the cops get here. What's up, man? Oh, thank you.
It was one of these guys.
Okay, guys, I appreciate it.
None of them were involved.
Okay, that's what I'm saying.
It was this guy's. It was that guy's.
Well, sir.
Get on the ground.
Hold up, sir.
I told you to stay. Get your ass is down on the ground.
So I'd like to point out what's going on in this clip. First, you see a bunch of police officers running full speed like they're the cop from Terminator 2. I don't see in this video anyone running in the direction they're running into. I don't know who they're chasing in this clip. All you see are police officers running full speed. And one police officer in particular, the officer who will easily take charge, you'll hear take charge in these clips, Corporal Eric Casebolt. You see him. Some people say that he tripped and fell. That's what they said in the video. Regardless, he gets to the ground and he does this barrel roll, this dramatic, like, barrel roll. He gets right back up and continues running after. Who knows who he's running after? I still can't tell watching the video. It's just over the top. Like, the dramatization. You would think this is a reenactment video on some cheap cable news TV show. And then you hear the kids, some of the 14-year-olds, maybe these ones, these kids were 50 and 16, they pick up his flashlight, and they're arguing over who's going to be the good kid to hand over the flashlight to the cops. Oh, you dropped this. These are the evil kids that these cops are dealing with. These terrible people they need to rally up, they need to get around and to make them disperse or sit on the floor. And then you hear one of the cops talking to the kids. You know, in a situation like this, you're a cop. You're sent out to look at a situation. You see a bunch of teenagers, and you need to get them to disperse. I would say talking to them is the proper measure to take. And then you hear an officer come over and start yelling. And that is, again, Officer Corporal Eric Casebolt. You even hear the cop sort of, the other cop who was talking to the kids sort of like, oh, whoa, okay. I mean, there's something going on here with this Corporal Eric Casebolt. I don't know if this is how he treats everyone he stops, and this is the first time he's been caught on camera, or if this is a guy who's been waiting, like this, he became a cop for this reason. And this fire he's been waiting to unleash has just been rising inside of him, waiting for a moment like this, waiting for a group of young black teens to cause some trouble so he can get them, yell at them and get them to sit on the ground and he could berate them. Now let's play this second clip, because things get way more disturbing than what you just heard.
Get your ass going! Oh, you don't say no money! Get right in your mouth!
Oh, my mother! All right. All right.
Please!
Oh, my mother!
All right. You know what? All right. Yo, Jelfer, what the fuck is going on? Why is he acting so crazy?
So this officer, Corporal Eric Casebolt, you know, this is just unbelievable. So this guy shows up to get this group of teens who apparently were at a pool party uninvited, which we'll get to that a little bit later and then better and later on in the show, because that's not the truth either. So he's called out there to apparently get these group of uninvited teens out of this pool party in this community. And they're running away when the police arrive. That sounds like you've done your job. They're no longer at the pool party causing a disturbance. They're gone. They're a bunch of 14, 15-year-olds. You could leave it there. But then, okay, you got another cop talking to some of the kids who haven't left yet. Cool. He'll talk to them, get them to leave. These kids seem like good kids. They're giving him the flashlight that you, Officer Casebolt, dropped while you're doing your fancy barrel roll. But then on top of that, you're telling people who aren't dispersed, you're yelling at people who aren't dispersing to disperse, and they start to disperse, and someone says something about calling their mother or whatever, and you don't like what you hear. So you go over to this 14-year-old girl wearing her swimming uniform, her bikini, and you grab her by the neck, and you force this 14-year-old girl to the ground, pushing her face into the grass. And then you take your knee and you dig it into her back. And I would like to say, we've cut this video up because it's a 7.5-minute long video. He is digging his knee, pushing her face to the ground for about 2-3 more minutes after that clip is cut before he gets off of her. And when he first gets on top of her, a bunch of her friends see what's going on and they gather around to say, "What are you doing? Get off of her." And he gets up. And he goes for his gun and he pulls it out as they start running because holy shit, there are a bunch of unarmed 14, 15-year-olds wearing their swimming trunks and a cop is pulling his gun out on them. I mean, it does not get any more ridiculous than this. The response to this is over the top. And, you know, Breitbart and other right-wing media outlets have this video of, you know, of apparently there was a fight before the pool or something like that. Who cares? Pulling a gun out at a bunch of unarmed teens is in no way the response you have to this disturbance. It's just unbelievable. And what we have much more to say about this. We have much more to say about this in the better half. So let's go to the better half. Freebies, thank you for joining us. If you'd like to become a member, go to majority.fm. Click become a member, and for less than a cup of coffee a day, you can support this show. You could also support this show by going to donateyouraccount.com, connecting your Facebook and Twitter accounts to our Donate Your Account, and we will post a single YouTube interview or audio podcast interview a day. Share with your friends. It's a good conversation starter. Get people to listen to the show. What else, Michael? JustCoffee.coop. Use coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off your entire order of fair trade coffee and chocolates. Free shipping. As my voice cracks, free shipping. What else? YouTube.com.
So excited you go prepubescent.
Yes, that's right. Fair trade coffee and chocolates with free shipping. Doesn't get any better than that.
And go, if you use Amazon, use it through our link. We got a kickback. Write us a review on iTunes. Thank you, everybody. We'll be right back. Oh, and if you want to join us, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. The IMs are open. We'll see you in the fun half.